Boker Tov, everybody. Hope everybody is doing well. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Rebecca Winter Gottlieb, who, as I'm sure many of you have either know or have figured out, grew up in Toronto, just a few blocks from where we live. And it's really a pleasure to welcome her to our series. Rebecca, I guess, earned her Tanakh credentials at a young age. She represented Canada in Chidon HaTanakh in the International Bible Contest. She taught, she coached, I think, for many years, some of the students going in Chidon HaTanakh. She taught the first year we ran the Matan, Mother and Daughter Bat Mitzvah program. Rebecca taught it for a couple of years. And then when she moved away, we lost her as a wonderful teacher. She's now living in Atlanta, as you may have heard. She has a PhD in clinical neuropsychology. She works in private practice and she teaches Tanakh at the Atlanta Jewish Academy, a student at Lindenbaum, at Matan, the GPath program at Stern. It's a pleasure to welcome her to teach here on Sefer Shoftim. Bakasha, Rebecca, it's all yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. It's wonderful to be back here with Torah in Motion. And I'm honored to be part of this great panel of speakers, and it's been wonderful to hear from everybody over the last, I guess, 6 days. So we are, as Rabbi Kelman maybe said, we are going to be embarking on this journey together of learning Sefer Shoftim. So I'm actually going to share my screen, and I know last week Rabbi Grumet all prepared for presentation. And just because of the nature of Sefer Shoftim, apps get through Sefer and to really understand the Sefer, I thought our point might be a little for people to follow. That Layla shared the source sheet for those of you who would like your own personal computers that way as well. So I've titled this year today, The Great Leadership Experiment, Sefer Shoftim. And we'll talk about why this is kind of an experiment in leadership as we go through this Sefer together. All right. So when people think about Sefer Shoftim, and of course, we're coming right off the cusp of Sefer Yehoshua from last week. When people think about Sefer Shoftim, the first thing that comes to mind, I think for most people is that Bnei Israel cycle through these stages throughout Sefer Shoftim. And to briefly summarize this cycle that's presented to us in Sefer Shoftim Perek Bet, we have Bnei Israel sin, Hashem sends an enemy, Bnei Israel then of course cries, and sends this Shofet in order to save Bnei Israel. And sometimes within that time period of following the Shofet saving Bnei Israel, we actually have a time of quiet and peace, which is very lovely for some of the Shoftim, until usually that Shofet dies or a new generation comes and Bnei Israel then return to sinning again. And I think that that's probably the most common theme and the theme that most people think of. They think of Sefer Shoftim. But I think in order to really understand the Sefer and how we even came to this cycle in the first place, we have to take several steps back to understand kind of the premise of the Sefer. So I'd first like to turn our attention to who wrote Sefer Shoftim, who was the author actually of the book. And in Gemara Baba Batra, as you could see on your screen, it says very...
Rebecca? I'm sorry to interrupt, but your sound is a little bit in and out, a little choppy.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm so sorry, everybody. Okay. I'm wondering what I could do about that. It's possible that I could switch locations. Okay.
If the problem continues, then you can call in.
Oh, okay. Well, let me see if everyone's okay, just waiting for 1 second. I'm happy to try switching locations to one that's a little bit easier to hear. My apologies, everybody.
It was fine before, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Well, of course, that's what always happens. All right. Everyone gets a little tour of my house here. And let's see if we can find something that's a little bit easier to hear. All right. Can you hear me now?
So far, so good. Let's see. Well, I'll let you know if there's a problem.
Okay. My apologies, everybody.
Yeah, someone said if you close any apps on your phone, I don't know if that, or on your computer, anything open.
Oh, okay. Okay, I think I'm mostly closed, but let me know about this connection if this is a little bit better.
Okay.
All right. So what we were talking about was who wrote Sefer Shoftim, and Sefer Shoftim is attributed to Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel himself was a Navi and a Shofet, and the Gemara in Baba Batra says that Shmuel katav Sifra v'Shoftim v'Ru. Shmuel wrote his own Sefer, Sefer Shmuel, which you'll learn about tomorrow, Sefer Shoftim, as well as Sefer Rut, Megillat Rut. And so in writing Sefer Shoftim, we understand that Shmuel, as a Shofet, he was the one who ushered in the era of monarchy. And we're not going to get into his Sefer too much, because of course, you'll learn it tomorrow. But I think it's important to understand that Sefer Shoftim is written within the context of, we know that this is going to be a period, we know that this is going to be a period of transition for Bnei Yisrael. They're transitioning from the times of Yahushua to the times of the monarchy. And in between, we have this period of Sefer Shoftim that Shmuel is going to try to explain to us essentially why it was that we came to the monarchy. Why was it that we actually essentially needed the monarchy after this period of Sefer Shoftim? Now, Sefer Shoftim is a 300-year period. So this is a very different scope from the book of Yehoshua, which was written over the course of probably about 40 years, one generation. Sefer Shoftim is many, many generations cycling through, as we said, different leaders. And so the question really is, for us, if it's true that we know that monarchy seemed to be inevitable, as we're going to learn tomorrow in Sefer Shmuel, and we know that Shmuel is going to be the one who ushers in the monarchy, why was it that we didn't just jump immediately from Yehoshua to establishing a monarchy, right? And so why was it that we had to go through this period of this cycle, these cycles of Shoftim? Why was it that we had to be in this period of constant turnover and turmoil? And so I think the answer to this really lies in two different places. The first place we're not going to get into too much because it's a much larger debate of the mitzvah of melucha, right? We know that in Sefer Dvarim, Perek Yud Zayin, Hashem tells us, Som tasim alecha melech, that you should make a king for yourself. And of course, there's a great debate about whether that's a lechatchila, whether that's something that Hashem wants a priori, or whether it's more b'di'evet, and it's something that Hashem wants and realizes that Bnei Yisrael really need. That's a debate that we're going to leave for now. But certainly, if we look at Sefer Shmuel, we know what Shmuel thinks and what Hashem, indeed, in Sefer Shmuel thinks of having a king. So I've brought some psukim for you, and we can read them together. In Sefer Shmuel, when Bnei Yisrael asked for a king, it says very clearly, "Vayera hadavar be'enei Shmuel, ka'asher amru tetzna lanu melech l'shoftenu, vayitpalel Shmuel al Hashem." So Shmuel thinks it's very bad for Bnei Yisrael to have a king. And what does Hashem say to Shmuel? "Vayomer Hashem al Shmuel, shma b'kol ha'am l'chol asher yamru alecha, ki lo otcha ma'asu, ki oti ma'asu mimlach alechem." Right? Hashem says, Shmuel, don't be insulted. I know that you're the Shofet of the time and it feels like you are kind of being usurped, but really Bnei Yisrael are rejecting me. And the Abarbanel so beautifully says, if you can see the bold, Aval Am Yisrael, unlike the other nations, Am Yisrael, Shehashem Elokehem, Malkam, V'huhin Lachem Lachem, V'hu HaMesader Mishpatehem, Al Pi HaTorah, Lo hayu tzrichim melech, right? Abarbanel says, well, what's Hashem saying? That Hashem is the one who fights their wars for them. Hashem is the one who is a shofet, who decides all of their judgments. Bnei Yisrael don't actually need a king. V'lachen amar shema asu et Hashem mimlach alehem. And therefore, Hashem says, you have rejected me when you ask for a king. And so it becomes clear, at least according to Shmuel himself, that having a king is not something that's a priori. This is not something that's ideal for Bnei Yisrael to have because God is their king, Hashem hu hamelech. And when B'nai Yisrael ask for a king, ki otima asu, right? Hashem feels he has been rejected because he is the ultimate king. And so we understand from this that Sefer Shoftim really is an inevitability, that B'nai Yisrael needed to have a time period where God was the king, and there were going to be these interim leaders who came in and out, who saved B'nai Yisrael, kind of were leaders as proxies, right, as secondary to God, but that God was really the ultimate king. And so at least according to Shmuel, in Shmuel's eyes, the progression should never have been Yehoshua and then a monarch, but rather there needed to be at least a trial period where no monarch was there at all. And so we can understand how we came to this period of the Shoftim, where there was no monarch, there was no leader that was passed down from father to son. All right. And so if we think about Sefer Shoftim, and we know, and we talked about this cycle, the second question that we might have is, well, okay, we understand now why we have these Shoftim who are coming in and out, because ultimately we have Hashem as the consistent Melech, as the consistent leader. But the question is, how did Bnei Yisrael come to enter this cycle in the first place? And in order to really understand that, we have to take a step back from Perek Bet, from the cycle, and enter into Perek Aleph of Sefer Shoftim. And Sefer Shoftim actually starts in a very similar way to the way Sefer Yehoshua started. And I'd like to make a quick comparison between Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph in Sefer Shoftim, and Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph in Sefer Yehoshua. And we'll read Sefer Yehoshua first. Vayihi acharei mot Moshe eved Hashem, after Moshe died, vayomer Hashem al Yehoshua binun, misharet Moshe lemor. Hashem spoke directly to Yehoshua, who was, of course, Moshe's attendant, Moshe's servant. And we know that Yehoshua then becomes the leader. Let's compare that to Pasuk Aleph in Sefer Shoftim. Vayihi acharei mot Yehoshua, after Yehoshua died, so very similar. Vayish'alu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem lemor. And b'nei Yisrael ask Hashem, saying, Mi ya'ale lanu et ha'kna'ani b'tchila lehilachem bo. Who is going to go first with us to fight against the Kna'anim? And if you look at the comparison between these two psukim, we see a progression from one great leader, Moshe in Sefer Yehoshua and Yehoshua in Sefer Shoftim. But very different in Sefer Shoftim, instead of one single leader rising up, we see that Bnei Yisrael as a people are approaching Hashem. In both cases, we have people, Yehoshua and Bnei Yisrael, having an interaction with God. They're asking of God and they're talking to God. And interestingly enough, in both places, they're both talking about the same thing, conquering Eretz Kna'an, conquering Eretz Yisrael. But in Sefer Shoftim, we're talking about a group of people, a group of Bnei Yisrael, asking from Hashem, who should be with us? Who would be the first people to conquer, to go up and conquer Eretz Kna'an? And so we see already in Sefer Shoftim that we're moving away from this one single strong leader to a much more amorphous leadership, right? That it's just maybe a group of people who have the authority to talk to Hashem all together. Now, this is not necessarily a positive or a negative thing. It's just a statement about Sefer Shoftim, which nicely fits into our model that we described by Shmuel before, that Hashem is ultimately the king, and everybody else, there's more of an amorphous leadership that's not specific to one certain person. The other thing that kind of comes to light in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim is a very glaring question. I think after we've completed our studies with Rabbi Tzvi Grumet last week, the first question we would ask about Sefer Shoftim is, why on earth are Bnei Yisrael still fighting with Amei Kna'an? Didn't we just learn in Sefer Yehoshua that Bnei Yisrael have completed their fights with Amei Kna'an? Why are they now going back to still fighting with Amei Kna'an? It really doesn't make any sense. In order to understand this, we need to go back to Sefer Dvarim. We need to go back to Sefer Dvarim and understand the initial plan for actually fighting with Amei Kna'an. initially, when Hashem talks about how Bnei Israel are going to possess Amek Na'an and they're going to take over and conquer the land, Hashem says, or Moshe says through Hashem in Sefer Dvarim, "V'nashal Hashem Elokecha et Hagoyim Ha'el Mipanecha Me'at Me'at Lo Tuchal Kalotam Maher Pen Tirbe Alecha Chayat Hasadeh." Right? Moshe says Hashem is going to let you conquer Amek Na'an, but he's only going to let you conquer them very, very slowly. And the reason given is because if the land is just desolate immediately, it could become much more difficult to then go and possess and settle, because wild beasts would multiply and they would come and attack you, right? If you just leave a plot of land open and empty for a long period of time, it's probably not easy for you to then go and kick those wild animals out and settle it. And so says Hashem, by design, strategically, you are only going to be able to conquer Amek Na'an very, very slowly. And so we understand that Sefer Yehoshua was very, very successful in conquering a lot of the major cities and at securing many of the borders and fighting off many of the larger enemies and armies that surrounded Eretz Canaan, Bnei Israel still had a lot of work to do that was probably going to take generations to complete. And as a fallout from this, what would inevitably happen is that a lot of people from Amek Na'an would still be living in the land of Eretz Yisrael. And so it was Bnei Yisrael's job in Sefer Shoftim to kick out all or possess all of the people who were left over, who had not been completely attacked in and driven out in Sefer Yehoshua. And as a consequence of this, Dvarim continues and warns us of the great dangers of this plan happening. Even though strategically this was the way that Bnei Israel needed to conquer the land, there was obviously going to be a fallout, and you might guess what it is. And it's repeated many times in Sefer Dvarim, and I'll just read briefly to you from Perek Yod Bet. In the second pasuk here, pasuk Lamed, Yishamer lecha pen tinakesh acharehem acharei hishamdami panecha, Upenti drush la Elohehem lemar, Echaya avdu hagoyim haele et Elohehem veasechen gamani. Even after you've driven them out, so even after you're gone, don't be swayed by their culture, don't be swayed by their religion. Lo taasechen Hashem Elokecha, ki chol toavat Hashem asher sane asu la Elohehem, ki gam epnehem vepnotehem yisrefu ba'esh la Elohehem. Right? So says the Torah, because you should not turn to Avodah Zarah. And the Torah points out a very specific form of Avodah Zarah, because everything that they do for Avodah Zarah is terrible, is degenerate, specifically when they offer up their sons and daughters to the fire, which is a description of the terrible form of Avodah Zarah called Molech. So what the Torah is worried about, essentially, is that as Bnei Israel are conquering the land, and there's still going to be remnants of Amek Na'an in there, those remnants and those people are still going to continue living there and influence Bnei Israel culturally and religiously. And so if we think about it, while Sefer Yehoshua was really about conquering the land, Sefer Shoftim then becomes about taking possession of the land, really fighting this religious and cultural war. How do we drive out the people who are left over, the people who are living in the smaller cities and the smaller towns? That really becomes the job of the Shvatim and then of the Shoftim in Sefer Shoftim. And the Rambam actually believes that this is probably the most important part of the battle, not necessarily to drive out the nations physically, but says the Rambam, im hishlimu in Hilchot Melachim, he says, im hishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot shenitzdavu bnei noach aleihen, ein horgim mehen neshama, v'harei hen lamas. So says the Rambam that even the Amek Na'an, we don't necessarily need to kill them. What we need to do is possess them. We need to make sure that we eradicate their religion, we eradicate their culture, and we have them, we give them the option of taking on the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, the seven Noahite laws. And if they're able to do that, then that's fine. They can continue paying taxes to us. But really, the real war here is fighting the battle of culture, of religion, right? Not necessarily driving the people out, but making sure that we're really settling, inhabiting, possessing the land culturally and religiously, so that we're not influenced by the Amekna. And the question in Perek Aleph of Shoftim is essentially, were Bnei Yisrael successful in this task? And you can imagine where we're going with this. While Shevet Yehuda, at the very beginning of our chapter, was largely successful, we see that our chapter continues in Shoftim Perek Aleph later on. We see Lo Harish Menashe, Ve'Ephraim Lo Harish, Asher Lo Harish, Naphtali Lo Harish, So these Shvatim, Menashe, Ephraim, Asher, Naphtali, Dan, they were not successful in inhabiting, in possessing the land, in being Morish at Haaretz, in truly inhabiting the land. And if you take a quick look at this map, which we'll use throughout the duration, the rest of this shiur, you'll notice the location of these Shvatim, right? Menashe right there in the middle, very, very large. Ephraim a little bit to the south. Asher in the north. Naphtali also in the north. Bnei Dan further down toward the middle south. Meaning these Shvatim that did not actually possess their enemies, they did not convert them, or they did not drive them out. They're located very, very centrally, and it's obvious we can understand now how the other Shvatim, like Ephraim, Binyamin, Yehuda, were also influenced, especially Yisachar, Zvulun. They were obviously very close to these Shvatim, Asher, Naphtali, Menashe, Dan, right? And we can understand how the inability of these Shvatim to kick out or to at least convert, like the Ramban says, to at least convert Amekna'an to away from the religion of Avodah Zarah, away from their degenerate ways, was going to influence all of Bnei Yisrael. And so this failure at the very beginning of Sefer Shoftim to truly possess and inhabit the land is essentially what leads us to this cycle. Bnei Yisrael are not sinning in a vacuum. They're not sinning just because they're sinning. They're sinning because they failed to actually complete the promise of Sefer Yehoshua, which was to truly inhabit the land. And so they became influenced by the people around them. They actually, even in some places, it says, for example, with Shevet Dan, that they dwelled among those people instead of the Kna'anim dwelling among them. Right? So those Amekna'an really influenced Bnei Yisrael, infiltrated their culture, leading to intermarriage, and ultimately Avodah Zarah, which is exactly what Sefer Dvarim warned us about. And so we understand how we enter this cycle. Bnei Yisrael are sinning because of a failure to truly possess the land, and that's why Hashem punishes them, and so we enter this cycle. And so while the idea of a shofet, which was kind of an interim leader while God is really the king, is doomed to fail from the beginning. Why? Because if Bnei Yisrael are not accepting God as a king consistently, then this model is always going to be doomed to fail. Because of Bnei Yisrael's failure to truly possess the land, they are not going to be consistently, constantly accepting Hashem as their king, like Shmuel and Hashem say in Sefer Shmuel, and therefore the model of the Shofet is destined really to do. But it's not really all doom and gloom at the beginning, and Shmuel is going to present us with different models of Shoftim that we're going to kind of parse apart and try to understand as we walk through the different Shoftim. And so I've provided you with a quick outline for Sefer Shoftim. We've already completed points 1 and 2, right? Perek Aleph is largely about failure to finish conquering Eretz Kna'an. Part 2 is about presenting us with that cycle that Bnei Yisrael enter because of that failure. We're then going to discuss the successful or good Shoftim from Perekim Gimel to Aleph, who are Otniel, Ehud, Shamgar, who's kind of a more minor Shofet, and Dvorah. We'll talk a little bit more extensively about Gidon, the Shofet, who is more of that transitional Shofet. And then we'll move into our 8 bad, negative, or more unsuccessful shoftim, including Avimelech, Tola, Yair, Yiftach, Yivtzan Elon, Avdon, and Shimshon, which completes the 13 shoftim that the bulk of the Sefer is about. Then we'll talk very briefly about the very last part of Sefer Shoftim, the last few prekim, which is really divided into three nauseating stories of Bnei Yisrael when there's anarchy and there's no leadership at all. All right. So working off of this outline, we'll first get a little bit more deeply into these good and successful shoftim and see how they fared in this model. We'll start off with Otniel ben Knaz, who came from Shevet Yehuda. We know that Shevet Yehuda was largely very successful in conquering many of the smaller cities, but nonetheless, they are our first to be antagonized by Kushan Rishathaim Melech Aram Naharaim, who we see comes from the northeast, and he antagonizes Bnei Yisrael from the north. Otniel ben Knaz is actually Kalev ben Yefune's brother-in-law. And so we have in Otniel, our very first shofet, we have a wonderful connection to the past. Otniel is inherently linked to our past leadership. Kalev ben Yefune was one of the two spies, along with Yehoshua bin Nun, who fought against the 10 spies to say that Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Kanaan, was able to be conquered and that we would be successful in conquering the land. So Kalev ben Yefune. So Otniel ben Knaz is almost a throwback to that previous ilk of leaders, that caliber of leadership. And in fact, the Yalkut Shimoni beautifully states, Ad shelo shak'a shmasho shel Moshe zarcha shmasho shel Yehoshua. Right? When Moshe's son went down, Yehoshua's son rose. And in the same way, Ad shelo shak'a shmasho shel Yehoshua zarcha shmasho shel Otniel ben Knaz. And when Yehoshua's son set, Otniel ben Knaz's son rose. So really presenting this beautiful link between Otniel ben Knaz, our first shofet, and the past previous leadership in Yehoshua and Moshe. And Otniel ben Knaz was so successful in his defeat of Kushan Rishathaim Melech Aram Naharaim that it says, Vatishkor ha'aretz 40 shana, that until his death he reigned successfully, he was successfully able to bring peace for Bnei Yisrael for 40 years, which is, as we know, a complete generation. Moving from Otniel, we're going to meet Ehud ben Gera, who came from Shevet Binyamin. Ehud ben Gera is everybody's favorite lefty, and he successfully conquers Eglon Melech Moav by famously stabbing him in the stomach with his left hand, which came as a surprise because most people use their right hands. He successfully, it seems single-handedly really, leads an army against Bnei Moav, who attack from the east. And about Ehud ben Gera also, it says beautifully, Vatishkor ha'aretz, not just 40 shana, not just one generation, Vatishkor ha'aretz 80 shana, two full generations of quiet after Ehud ben Gera. Beautiful. After Ehud, we meet Shamgar ben Anat. Not a lot is known about Shamgar. Some commentators, at least in Masachat Sukkot and Gemara and Sukkot, place him in the south, coming from Shimon. He fights over there in the west. He fights the Plishtim. It says that he slew 600 Plishtim with a Milamed Bakar, which is really incredible. And we know that many opinions actually, even though it doesn't say that he brought peace, Vatishkor ha'aretz 40 shana, many people say that because it says Ve'acharav haya, after Ehud came Shamgar, they're really linked together and they almost had a dual leadership. So that because Ehud probably did not actually lead for 80 full years, that would be pretty impossible. Shamgar actually led for the latter 40 years of that generation. And he's also attributed to bringing peace for Bnei Yisrael. And finally, in our last of this grouping of shoftim, we have Devorah from Shevet Ephraim. Devorah was successful in defeating Yavin Melech Knaan, along with his very infamous Tsar Tzava, Sisra. Yavin entered Bnei Yisrael through the north, which is probably why she recruited Barak ben Avinoam in the north to try to galvanize power in this middle section where Yavin ben Lachna'an and his Sartzeva Sisra were fighting in Emek Yisrael, which kind of runs through this north to middle of Israel area. And so Devorah, along with Barak, defeats Yavin Melech Knaan. Some interesting points about Devorah herself. She was the only one who was also a Nevi'ah. And she's the only Shofet, interestingly, we're not going to harp on this too much, but she's the only one who actually was a Shofet, who actually judged Bnei Yisrael in her lifetime, right? All the other Shoftim are given the title of being a judge. But interestingly, what we really learn and understand about them is just their military victories and their military pursuits. We don't really hear about them judging Bnei Yisrael. Devorah, it says, Vaya'alu aleha Bnei Yisrael lamishpat. They came to hear her judgment, which is a unique, something unique about Devorah, and really gives her that nice title of Shofetet in many other ways. Now, what's interesting about Devorah, and I would like to turn your attention to the map very quickly. What's interesting about Devorah and about the other Shoftim of her time is that even though these are obviously very positive figures presented to us by Shmuel Hanavi, we'll notice that unlike Yehoshua, who really was the leader of all of Bnei Yisrael, we're looking at wars here that are fought in very specific and discrete areas of Bnei Yisrael, really sticking to the Shevet, really sticking to tribal wars. So Ehud ben Gera, he fought his war against Moab really just for Shevet Binyamin. So these are very, very specific. Their power is really discrete to their Shevet. And we see this really come to light with Devorah, who tries her best to unite at least the northern tribes of Bnei Yisrael, but she criticizes them when she sings about her victory in the famous Shirat Devorah in Perek Hay of Shoftim. She says, Gilad be'ever ha'yarden shachen, right? Gilad, who is Menashe over here on the other side of the Yarden, they never came to help me. And what about happened to Dan? Lama yagur aniyot? And what about Asher, Yashav lachof? Where were they? They were all affected by Yavin, and yet they didn't come to help me. She also criticizes Zvulun, Naphtali. Where were all these Shvatim when I asked you to come and help? And so what we learn about these positive Shoftim, we'll get to that in just a second. What we learn about these positive Shoftim is that while they were very successful in their individual wars and in bringing about peace, as it says about Devorah also, Vatishkot Haaretz Arba'im Shana, she was also able to maintain peace in her generation before the cycle jump-started again. What we learn about them is that they were never really able to galvanize, to unite the people of Eretz Yisrael in the way that Yehoshua really was able to do. And so a quick summary of these Shoftim, they definitely succeeded in following that cycle narrative that we talked about and save Bnei Yisrael from their oppressors. We have for all of them, even we can say Shamgar ben Anat, Vatishkot Haaretz, definitely Arba'im Shana for most of them. They maintain peace for their generation, which is really a remarkable thing. That's a long time. However, they did not succeed in uniting the people in the way that Yehoshua was able to do. And so that really seems to be the one downfall, the one pitfall of these more positive Shoftim, despite their very strong attributes as leaders, in the way that Shmuel at least presents them in Sefer Shoftim. And so as Bnei Yisrael continue to cycle through this cycle of having quiet for 40 years and then coming back and sinning again, we are introduced to who I would call our transitional crossover Shofet, Gidon. Gidon comes from Sefer Menashe, Gidon comes from the tribe of Menashe. He fights against the Midianim, who are kind of a nomadic people, but it seems like at that time they were wandering around in the desert in the south, and they come up and start antagonizing Menashe in the middle to north of the country. And while Gidon is extremely successful in eradicating the Midianim with only 300 foot soldiers, which is really remarkable, as Gidon and his foot soldiers are continue to chase the Midianim, they're continuing to chase two of the Midianite kings named Zebach and Salmuna. And they're kind of running through this Emek Yisrael, again, this kind of area in the middle of the country. And they come to two cities. One of them is named Sukkot, and one of them is named Penuel in the Menashe Ephraim region. And Gidon says to them, you know, can you please come and help me out? We've been running, we have been chasing Zebach and Salmuna, these princes of Midian. We've been chasing them for a very long time. My soldiers are exhausted. And he asked the people of Sukkot, please, and Penuel, please, can you help us? Give us some water, give us some food, something. And the people of Sukkot and Penuel say, well, you know, we're happy to help you, Gidon, but only once you actually capture these kings. And Gidon says to them, well, once I capture these kings, I am going to punish you. And we can read about it here. Vayavo el anshei Sukkot in Shoftim Perachet. Vayomer, hine zevach v'tzamuna asher cheraftem oti lemor, hachaf zevach v'tzamuna atabi adecha, kini ten la'anshecha ayafim lechem. Right, so Gidon says, look, guys, I actually captured these two princes, Zevach and Salmuna, and you decided that you weren't going to help us in our time of need. So what does Gidon do? Vayikach et ziknei ha'ir v'et kotzei hamidbar v'et habarkanim, Vayodabahem et anshei Sukkot. So he brings desert thorns and he punishes the people of Sukkot. Most people translate this to be that he kills them or at least very severely, severely injures the people of Sukkot. Vet migdal penuel natatz vayaharog et anshei ha'ir. And he tears down the tower of Penuel and he kills its townspeople. So for the very first time, what we see with Gidon is that despite his strength and bravery in capturing the people of Midian, unlike Devorah, who just sings about and gets angry at the Shvatim who did not help her, Gidon is physically punishing those in Bnei Israel who refused to help him in his time of need. And Rabbi Chaim Angel writes a very fascinating article, and I think the Jewish Bible Quarterly, probably at least over a decade ago, he wrote about this. And he talks about how Gidon is a very complex character. And he notes, and I just lifted this from, and I lifted this from one of his presentations. And Rabbi Chaim Angel says that really Gidon kind of presents two sides of the coin. In some ways, he has very idealistic motivations. And in some ways, he has very personal motivations. And you can see at the very top over there on our chart, his reason for punishing Sukkot and Penuel could be for national security, but it could also be because they mocked Gidon. If we go back briefly, it says, Asher cheraftem oti, right? You were specifically mocking me. It's not that it was a national security issue, even though it was. Gidon's soldiers were very hungry and very tired. Gidon is personally insulted. And so continues Rabbi Angel. He says, why did he then kill Zebach and Salmuna? There's a narrative there that says, well, on one hand, he killed Zebach and Salmuna because they're the Midianite princes. They're the kings, right? And they needed to be killed. They were the enemies of Bnei Israel. But while he's talking to Zebach and Salmuna, he also slips in that he's angry at them personally for killing his own brothers. And so again, there seems to be this this two-sided coin for Gidon. In some ways, he's idealistic. In some ways, he has these personal motivations. Then, when he's about to kill the kings, these Zebach and Salmuna, he first tries to get his eldest son, Yeter, to kill the kings, seemingly to for the family vendetta, right? Seemingly in order to appease or to avenge the deaths of his own brothers. And possibly also because it seems like he might be grooming his son to take over from him in the first time that we might see that there's a succession of a father to son in the leadership of Bnei Israel. And so that's a very personal reason for that action. But then Bnei Israel, it seems, really do see him, at least the people of Menashe, really do see Gidon as their king. And they approach Gidon and they say, Gidon, please become our king. You are such a kingly figure. You can be our monarch. And Gidon actually declines the request, right? He says, no, actually, just like Shmuel says, Hashem hu hamelech. We can't do that. That's not a model that I could follow. The model that we're in right now is that God is the ultimate king. And afterwards, though, Gidon then says, but what you could do is give me all your silver and gold, and I'll make a breastplate and ephod, seemingly on one hand to commemorate my great victory against Midian, which God, of course, helped me with, or also really to become a shrine to me, to my great victory. And we know actually that this ephod became a trap for Bnei Israel, and Bnei Israel actually began worshiping this ephod, and it became a great trap for them. And finally, Gidon has a son who he names Avimelech, which, as Rabbi Angel points out, could be that Avimelech, right, God is my king, which was really Gidon's party line, or it could be that secretly, really, Gidon had personal motivations, right? Avimelech, that Gidon saw himself as a king, and so he names his son Avimelech, God is king. Finally, what's interesting about Gidon, unlike the other shoftim that we saw before him, it says, Kinashim rabot hayula, that he had many wives, which is often a pitfall or attributed to many of our monarchs who we see in Sefer Shmuel and Melachim, that he took for himself many, many wives, really showing his strength and his power. And so even though about Gidon, it also says, Vatishkod ha'aretz arba'im shana, it says that he also was able to bring peace for 40 years. What we're really ushering in is a new era of shoftim, an era that we're looking at really this right side here, an era of shoftim who are motivated by personal power, personal goals, moving away from the more idealistic motivations that we saw at the very beginning of Sefer Shoftim. And so as we move on from Gidon, we see that the next shofet is actually his son, Avimelech. For the very first time, there is no outside enemy that we learn about from Avimelech. Instead, Avimelech uses great force against his own people, against his own brothers. I brought one example. Vayavo beit aviv Ephrata, vayaharog et Echav. So he's killing his own brothers. He also wages a war against the people of Shechem, which is again an Israelite city, in his own Shevet in Menashe. And so Avimelech very much takes on that personal motivation side in a very negative way. After Avimelech, we're introduced to some of the more minor shoftim. We have Tola from Yisachar. We don't know a lot about him, but we see that he ruled for 23 years. And then we have Yair after him from Shevet Menashe. We don't know a lot about him either, but he reigned for 22 years. What we also see about Yair is that he had many, many children. He had great wealth, kind of hearkening back to that more personal side or some of those attributes that we talked about with Gidon. What we also note about these more minor shoftim is that while we're used to hearing from our earlier shoftim that they had the land that was quiet for 40 years, here we have Vayishpot et Israel. They reigned over Israel for only half a generation. So we're moving away from a model of true peace for 40 years, for a generation, to being able to reign or lead for only half a generation. After those two shoftim, sorry about that, we have Yiftach HaGiladi, Yiftach HaGiladi, who's also from Shevet Menashe, and Yiftach fights against Bnei Amon. Yiftach is famously known for fighting against Bnei Amon, but making kind of a reckless shvua. He says to Hashem, if you deliver Bnei Amon into my hands, then I will sacrifice the first thing that comes out of my house. And I have the Lashon for you here. Vayidor Yiftach neder la Hashem. Yiftach has a neder for Hashem. Vayomar im natanti tena Bnei Amon biyadi. V'haya ha-yotzer she-yotze midlatei beiti likrati b'shubi b'shalom ibnei Amon v'haya la-Hashem v'alitihu olah. If you give Bnei Amon into my hands, then the first thing that comes out of my house, I will sacrifice. This is, according to most Parshanim, a very reckless shvua that he makes, because the first thing that comes out of his house is his one and only child, his daughter, who he then has to, according to the pshat, who he then has to sacrifice in order to fulfill his neder. Rav Michael Haddon actually explains in one of his essays from Yeshivat Har Etzion, Rav Michael Haddon explains that if you look very closely at these words that Yiftach uses, it's clear that Yiftach knows that it's going to be a human being, not an animal, who comes out of his house. He specifically focuses on Bahaya Hayotzer Asheyetze Midalte Beiti, right? Not an animal. An animal doesn't usually come out of a personal dwelling, out of a house, but rather a person comes out of a personal dwelling. And so what Rav Michael Haddon so nicely says, he explains in the larger context, what this episode corroborates is that we have sorrowfully suspected. Israel and its leaders in this horrible culmination of the insidious process that we have seen underway since the book began have become indistinguishable from their Canaanite nemesis. And so we see here with Yiftach, at least according to Rav Haddon, that Bnei Yisrael have now, and their leader in Yiftach, have now succumbed to Molech, have now succumbed to child sacrifice. Even though Yiftach was a successful shofet and successfully defeating Bnei Amon, he's actually remembered in the end by getting into a fight with the people from Ephraim and killing many of them. So evoking this civil war between Ephraim as he gets angry at them that they did not help him fight and defeat Bnei Amon. After Yiftach, we have three more minor shoftim, starting with Ivtzan from Yehuda, who reigned for 7 years, had many sons and daughters, again, clearly and likely many wives. Elon, who came from Shevet Zvulun, who reigned for 10 years, and Avdon ben Hillel, who is from Ephraim, who also had many wives and many children. Finally, our last shofet, who's probably the most famous shofet, is Shimshon, who came from Shevet Dan, who fights against the Plishtim. What's interesting about Shimshon is that even though Shimshon was the shofet for Shevet Dan, Shimshon only acts really in a personal vendetta against the Plishtim. And all of the wars that he fights against the Plishtim are really for personal gain. So you'll notice that Shimshon first starts off by intermarrying. He asks his parents if he could marry this Philistine woman from Timnah. The first war that he wages against the Plishtim is because he's angry at them because they weren't really able to successfully solve this riddle. So he kills many of the Plishtim. He then goes on to kill many others because he gets very angry that when he goes away for a little bit of time and sleeps with a prostitute, his father-in-law gives his wife to somebody else, this woman from Timnah. And so he goes on to continue killing more and more of the Plishtim. Finally, ultimately, Shimshon is taken down by the infamous Delilah, who tries to find out what is the source of his great strength. Shimshon was a Nazir, he was a Nazirite, so he never cut his hair, and he eventually succumbs to her wiles, and he tells her, well, if you cut my hair, then I won't have any power, which she does. Shimshon is then captured by the Plishtim, and in a very last feat of strength, he cries out to Hashem, asking him for the strength to defeat the Plishtim, but very much keeping within this personal vendetta motif, that's very famously a song. He says, Zachrenina v'chazkenina achapam hazeh ve'enakma nekamachat mishteinai mipilishtim. He says to Hashem, please let me take my revenge against the Plishtim because I'm angry at them. Not that it will be helpful for the security of Bnei Yisrael, but rather that I personally am angry at the Plishtim. And so if we could summarize this list of shoftim, these shoftim, we notice a few things, character traits about them. The first is that they are very self-serving, like Shimshon and Yiftach, Yiftach and Gidon. Second, they're always in search of power. Third, this group of shoftim introduced civil fights between the different shvatim and between the different cities. Finally, we have that the language that we notice shifts from Vatishkot Haaretz, that the land was peaceful and quiet from the earlier Shoftim to Vayishpat, that they ruled, but that the land was not quiet. And we also see that their amount of time that they ruled for varied from between 6 years and the maximum 23 years. And because of this, because they were just ruling and it wasn't really a peaceful time, we're not surprised to find that while in the previous Prakim, in our very early Prakim with Ehud, Devorah, and Otniel, it says that Bnei Yisrael returned to Hashem and there was peace during their times. Instead, here it says, Vayosifu Bnei Yisrael asod hara b'enei Hashem, that Bnei Yisrael continued to do bad. So even when the Shoftim came in and saved Bnei Yisrael from their enemies, this did not result in a return to Hashem, but into a continuation of continued Avodah Zarah. And what the Gemara says about the time period of Sefer Shoftim, Gemara Rosh Hashanah, says famously that each Shofet was nicely and uniquely matched to their generation. Yiftach bedora kishmuel bedora. Yiftach for his generation was like Shmuel for his generation. So that what we learn from the Gemara is that the Shoftim were a reflection of the people who they were leading, and the people were a reflection of the Shofet. So if we go back to these attributes that we talked about with these more negative Shoftim in the latter half of Sefer Shoftim, when we talk about self-serving in search of power, civilly fighting, these are attributes not just, according to the Gemara at least, of these Shoftim, but also of Bnei Yisrael at the time. The Gemara also talks about how it was a dor sheshofet et shoftav. It was a generation that judged its judges, which makes sense, right? A judge who tries to tell you how to act, but who he himself is not acting piously, is not going to be successful in converting Bnei Yisrael in any way. And so the generations and the Shoftim really matched each other. And it's not surprising, therefore, that the very end of Sefer Shoftim ends in a period of anarchy, where there is no Shofet at all, because essentially Bnei Yisrael have rejected all forms of leadership. And so while we think about the cycle of Shoftim that I presented at the very beginning, it's more of a downward spiral, where Bnei Yisrael toward the end weren't actually returning to Hashem in any way, but they had reached a downward spiral where they were consistently, constantly in this period of serving other gods and not serving Hashem. And so it is with this in mind that we reach the very end of Sefer Shoftim, which starts with the story of Pesel Micha, where Micha, this man, he from Ephraim, he builds this Pesel. He steals actually his mother's money. He builds an idol for worship. And he also recruits a man to be a fake Kohen for him. And of course, this is epitomizing Avodah Zarah. Interestingly for Micha, his mother actually praises him. Good job on stealing my money. Good job on making this idol, showing us that idol worship at that time was rampant. The story then moves to our second story in the latter, the very, very end of Sefer Shoftim, which is the nauseating and terrible story of Pilegesh Bagivah, where there's a man who has a Pilegesh. She ran away. He then goes to drag her back. And as he takes her back, he brings her to a town in Binyamin. In that town in Binyamin, he stays over at a man's house. And the people in this town, in the Gilboa and Binyamin, the people in this town knocking on his door. They say that they're not happy that there's a guest in their town. And eventually the man throws his Pilegesh out of the house and she's raped repeatedly by the people of Binyamin. He opens the door the next day, this man, and he finds her lying on the doorstep. He then chops her up into 12 different pieces, sends her body to the rest of Bnei Yisrael, to all the 12 Shvatim, to show them how terrible Binyamin is. And so we have this terrible sin of Gilui Arayot. The final story of Sefer Shoftim is really a continuation of the story of Pilegesh Bagivah, where Bnei Yisrael enter into a civil war with Binyamin and results in true Shvichut Damim, results in really the almost near eradication of one of the Shvatim in Bnei Yisrael, trying to punish them for this terrible crime that they did in raping this Pilegesh, this concubine. What's terrible really about this civil war is that it's actually the only time we see in Sefer Shoftim where there's a true unity of Bnei Yisrael. As we said, the Shoftim had such a difficult time galvanizing the power of the entire nation until finally there was a civil war. And it says three times in Perek Kaf, Ke'ish Echad, that Bnei Yisrael gathered like one against their own. There was not an external enemy at this point, but rather they were fighting within. But at that point, they were able to gather together, Ke'ish Echad. It also says very sadly, it really reminds us of the very beginning of Sefer Shoftim, where Bnei Yisrael were trying to figure out, how should we conquer Eretz Kanaan? How should we fulfill the promise of Sefer Yehoshua to truly possess the land? Here at the very end of Sefer Shoftim, Vayakumu Vayalu Beit El, Vayishalu Ba'elokim, Vayomru Bnei Yisrael, Mi Ya'ale Lanu Batzchila LaMilchama Im Bnei Binyamin, who should be the first one to go up against the tribe of Binyamin, not Knaan, but our own brethren, Binyamin. And in the same way as Hashem said at the beginning, Yehuda Batzchila, so too the Urim V'Tumim respond at the end, Yehuda Batzchila, Yehuda will go first. But this time in attacking their own, in attacking Shevet Binyamin. And so in this downward spiral, we can now understand in this true rejection of God, we can now understand why Shmuel b'di'eved and really was forced then to write as he does four times at the very end of Sefer Shoftim, Bayamim ha'heim, in those days, Ein melech b'Yisrael, it was complete anarchy, Ish ha'yashar b'einav yaseh, people were doing whatever they thought was most right in their eyes. Or maybe a more appropriate way of reading this in terms of our thesis and hypothesis about Sefer Shoftim, in those days, Bayamim Hahein, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, meaning the Melech, God, was no longer recognized in Yisrael, and therefore, Ish HaYashar B'Einav Yaseh, because of Bnei Yisrael's inability to recognize Hashem as their king, Hashem as their God, Hashem as their king, Ish HaYashar B'Einav Yaseh. Every man did as they pleased. And so ends the tumultuous time of Sefer Shoftim, which gives us the explanation and ushers in the new era of Sefer Shmuel, which you'll learn about tomorrow. And that's all I have for today. So thank you all for listening. I'm very happy to take any questions, and I hope that you got a small taste of Sefer Shoftim's this 300-year period of the Shoftim.
Thank you very much. Rebecca, why don't you take a look at the chat box? I'll just make, I guess, a couple of announcements. You can see there are quite a number of questions for you. Great. That you can hopefully get to. Just while Rebecca's doing that, of course, tomorrow, Rachel Sharansky Danziger will be talking on Shmuel. Thursday, Rabbi Nadi Helfgott on Malachim. So we'll be finishing Nevi'im Rishonim. Next week, next Tuesday, we'll go a little bit of order. After Rabbi Strachler does his shiur on Sefer Yeshayahu, we'll do Megillat Eicha, Josh Berman. Rabbi Josh Berman will do Megillat Eicha because Thursday is Tish B'Av. Tish B'Av will be having at least 5 hours of programming, maybe more. We'll be publicizing that soon. So far, the speakers from Israel will be having a like pretty much an all-afternoon program on Tisha B'Av. So we'll send you all the details about that soon. A number of people have asked all the recordings, any shiurim you've missed, of course, they're on the website. Just go to the Torah Motion website under podcast, past programming. All the source sheets are recorded there if you want to look at the source sheet. So I want to thank you, Rebecca. Yes, it was a wonderful share, as you see from all the comments. And if you've had a chance to look at some of the questions, I'll let you handle all the questions. And This evening, Mark Shapiro, of course, will be continuing his class 8:30 this evening. Hope to see you there. Okay, Bakasha.
Okay.
Rebecca.
Okay, so let's see from the beginning. In Shoftim, it says everyone does what is correct in their own eyes. So in Shoftim, it says not having a king. Okay. Yeah, is the cause of all the problems. So I think we answered that question toward the end of the with the Lord as king, don't you need a constant presence, Moshe, a Moshe-like figure to communicate between God and the people recognized by all? I would say that absolutely, right? There seemed to be a... Moshe and Yahushua seem to be much more successful than any of the Shoftim. It seems that the Shoftim really... One of the downfalls of the Shoftim was that they were not able to galvanize that power. So while Otniel, let's say, would be our best example of kind of the proxy for Yahushua, even he was not able to get that strength and to gain that power altogether. And that really could have also been a function of the Shvatim really separating, kind of creating this division, that they were each trying to settle their own area, which kind of led to a much more fractured form of leadership. So it's unclear if even Moshe or Yahushua in that time period would have been as successful as they were in the Midbar or really in the beginning of the conquering of Israel. I'm not sure if that answered that really, but we could talk about that more, let's say. So peaceful times for 160 years or four generations. Was there ever a time with kings that was as peaceful and successful? Excellent question, right? It could be argued that really Shmuel is focusing here in Sefer Shoftim on the negatives of Sefer Shoftim while kind of leaving out the more boring parts, which is that really in the times of those first four Shoftim, there was a period of 160 years which were peaceful, which is wonderful. And the idea that the monarch, that there were a lot of failures with the monarchy, is not necessarily a reflection on, well, the Shoftim was the better model, right? It could be, and as you'll learn in Sefer Shmuel and Melachim, that there were a lot of things that went wrong with the model of the monarchy that was employed by Shmuel, Shaul, and David, and then the subsequent monarchs. So having a successful and peaceful monarchy is not necessary, or a shorter successful peaceful monarchy is not necessarily a reflection on the success or failures of the Shoftim. But that's an excellent point, right? That there was very a long period of time, at least for the early Shoftim, where there was a lot of peace. What did ruling mean for their own tribe or for all of Bnei Israel? I think we established that it was really very tribal. It was really very Shevet based. What evidence is there for a unity among Israelite tribes to feel themselves a united people? I think we've proven that Bnei Israel could come together, ki'ish echad. They can galvanize that power to come together as one, but they were unable to against the external enemies and unfortunately only able to fight their own. Why does the Ruach Hashem fill Yiftach just before he utters his vow? That's an excellent question, but to hear lav Ruach Hashem. This is also true with Gidon, right? Gidon also kind of makes this quid pro quo with God before he goes to fight against the Midianim. I mean, it could be that Yiftach is filled with this spirit of Hashem because right before he went to war, Hashem was helping him. But what was actually the content of the vow is more up to Yiftach, right? That was something that he came up with by himself. You could say that it really would refute Rav Michael Haddon's argument that this was, that he really did believe that it was going to be a human being. And that he really thought that it was going to be an animal. So that's definitely a possible refutation of what he was saying. And something else about Yiftach's vow, since his vow was formulated in the masculine, couldn't that have been used to refute any application to Yiftach's daughter? I don't think so. I think that the masculine form is classically and typically used to refer to both either male or female. And it could be that Yiftach was not thinking it would necessarily be his daughter, but any member of his household, which would make it clear that using the masculine would have kind of covered any human being coming out of the house. Was Yiftach's sacrifice to his daughter a sacrifice to Molech, reflecting the fact that Israel needed a Melech or a king? I think that it's possible, and definitely Rav Michael Haddon would say that it's of that ilk, that it was sacrificing to Molech because he was influenced by the people who were unable to be driven out in Shevet Menashe by the Amei Knaan. Does that reflect the fact that Bnei Israel needed a Melech or a king? Maybe, possibly. I might agree with that, and really depending on the type of king and the type of monarchy that's set up, which you'll talk about tomorrow. Let's see. Excellent. It does not say that he actually sacrificed his daughter. That is actually true, right? It says that he fulfilled his vow, but not that he sacrificed his daughter. And many Parshanim actually do read Yiftach as that he separated his daughter, he banished his daughter to the mountains where she lived out the rest of her life, and that she never got married, and she was never able to come into her own self-fulfillment, but that he did not actually sacrifice her. That's true. Other Parshanim read it as that he fulfilled his vow means he fulfilled his vow. Now, Tanti 10, I'm going to give whatever comes out of my house to God. Yeah, so maybe we need like a full class on Yiftach. Let's see. What is the significance of using the word Vayishpat, which ordinarily means to judge? Excellent. Yes. So even though we said that Devorah was really the only Shafetet, the use of the word Vayishpat does seem to indicate that these people also did some judging in their lives. Absolutely. And I would agree with that, that maybe here Vayishpat, they were doing some judging. They were doing some judgment. It's not really as explicitly written as it is with Devorah, but it seems like it's possible that these latter Shoftim were still judging Bnei Israel in whatever capacity that would be. Clearly at a weaker level than obviously Devorah was because of the nature of those Shoftim, as we pointed out. Since each Shofet was local, when peace reigned, was it local or across all of Israel? Excellent question. I would say that it was a local peace that was accomplished because these were local wars that were fought, but that the rest of Bnei Israel could have been enjoying peace and could have been at any point in that cycle along the way. So while there was peace in one area, it's possible that in another area there was also peace, but that those people were then slowly being turned by Ameknaan who were still residing there. Again, I think it's clear from Sefer Shoftim that these are very, very tribal and discrete wars. And really, we're not talking about an entire nation enjoying the effects of these wars necessarily. Although certainly in the periphery, right, Binyamin would enjoy a war that was fought by Yehudah and won just because of their location. The story of Pilagash Bagivah seems to echo the angel's visit to Lot's home in Sodom. Excellent. I think that's one of the very clear parallels. And I think it really points to Bnei Israel's depravity of the time. When we think of like the most depraved people we can think of, we think of really the story of Sodom and Amorah, people who were, they were so depraved and so terrible that Hashem said the only way that this can be fixed is by completely destroying Sodom and Amorah, completely eradicating them. And so by equating Bnei Israel of our time, of Sefer Shoftim, to the people of Sodom and Amorah, we're almost saying the same thing, that Bnei Israel had sunk to a level of the only thing that could save them was to kind of totally wipe them out, which did not happen, thank God, but just emphasizes the depravity and the level that they met, that they reached. Is there a connection between Pilagash Bagivah and the story of Lot? Yes, I think we just talked about that. Why does God answer that Yehuda should go first instead of a different response, knowing it was for civil war? Excellent question. I think that brings us really to the use of the Urim V'Tumim, which is how Bnei Israel at that time were primarily communicating with God. This is a very, very different way from the way Yehoshua or Moshe communicated with God, which was much more direct and in conversation. Bnei Israel here and subsequently in subsequent books, and especially as you'll see in Sefer Shmuel tomorrow, are communicating with God via the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim is not necessarily going to give a response that is making a judgment call on Bnei Israel or that is necessarily guiding them in a better direction, right? As a direct response from God. But rather, Urim V'Tumim is classically used in a military sense, from a strategic perspective, who would be the best, how should we attack? And so the Urim V'Tumim is not used as a question of more morale. The Urim V'Tumim is sometimes misused in times where a war should not be happening, or in times where what the person is doing is not correct, as we'll see at the end of Sefer Shmuel. Instead, here, the Urim V'Tumim is just being used as a tactical device, as a tactical object, how would it be best to attack Binyamin? And so the Urim V'Tumim is used in this way. But Urim V'Tumim does not make a judgment call, does not stymie the asker from the question that they're asking, and is not going to start saying, well, that's moral, immoral, that's not ethical, you shouldn't go through with this war to begin with. It's not the same as talking to God directly. Let's see. There was no king. There was no king. Couldn't king mean a military leader and not God? Absolutely. I think that the pshat reading is that they needed a different form of leadership. And that's probably what you'll talk about tomorrow in Sefer Shmuel. Someone who, asher yetzeh lifnehem, asher yavol lifnehem, someone who's able to rule the military and to galvanize the power of the people. My personal read was you can also read it as God. And I read it in that way just to kind of encapsulate our thesis, which was that Bnei Yisrael had left God, left this model of Hashem Hu HaMelech. And so Ein Melech Yisrael could also reflect this ungodly time that Bnei Yisrael were going through. I think either one could be an accurate reading, but I think the more pshat reading is, as Steve pointed out, that there was no military lead, there was no king. Okay, let's see. Might the terrible fate of the Pilegesh be taken as a metaphor for the Shekhinah, the brutalization of God's presence among the people? Fascinating. I don't fully understand the question, Joel, but I'm happy to engage in this conversation. I don't fully understand.
I'll unmute people in a moment. If you're very serious and if you can, I can unmute in one second. I just think there's
okay, one. Okay, I'm happy to revisit this question. Why didn't the central movable sacrificial place of worship act as a unifying principle for the people? Cultural unity first, then political unity. Beautiful. Right, so we know that the central sacrificial place of worship was the Mishkan, which was, we don't really know where it was located in the times of Shoftim, but we assume, it was toward the middle of the country in Shiloh, which is what we'll find out in Sefer Shmuel. What we find out in Sefer Shmuel, I don't want to give too much away because we know that you're going to have a wonderful shiur about Sefer Shmuel tomorrow. What we know about it is that even though that is where there should have been central unity, there actually was not. And that really brings about the question of not just a single leader of Eretz Yisrael as a king, but that it was important to have multiple sources of power, a Kohen, a Navi, even a Shofet, along with a king, who all play to different strengths. Obviously, the Navi and the Kohen, who would play up the religious, cultural, that central power of Shiloh, and then the king and the Shofet, who maybe would look at the more judicial and military perspective. So the fact that we do not have a Navi or a Shofet at this time, and we only have, a Navi or a Kohen at this time that's really spoken about at all, really, really points to this deficit where it's true that the Mishkan was there in Shiloh, but it was definitely overlooked, and we don't see any centralization, any unity coming around Shiloh. And that's very, very much discussed at the very beginning of Sefer Shmuel, with Eli and Shmuel's leadership. And you can absolutely get into that tomorrow. Or I could talk more about it offline. There are not opinions that the Pilegesh story is not in chronological sequence, but placed there to introduce Shmuel. Absolutely, there are many biblical scholars who say that the language of the Pilegesh story is actually an earlier language and reflects the language of Yehoshua and Sefer Dvarim much, much more than it does the very beginning of Sefer Shoftim. And really, that really emphasizes the point that Shmuel Hanavi very thoughtfully organized and put together Sefer Shoftim. Even though it's possible that the story of the Pilegesh and the story of the civil war with Binyamin happened much earlier, it seems that Shmuel deliberately placed them at the end to show us the depths and depravity that Bnei Yisrael had reached, and really to usher in his own Sefer Shmuel. So I think that's very correct that there are opinions like that. That's not our Misora, but there are many opinions that are like that. And I don't think it necessarily takes away from the main point. I think the main point is the absence of God. Yes, I would agree. The parallel Pilagesh Bhagivat to Stum feels that a Stum-like Holocaust is required. I think we talked about that briefly. And the ensuing civil war that just about wiped out Binyamin qualifies. Excellent. So you're trying to say, Ruth Shane is saying that it's possible that actually Hashem was actually sanctioning the war against Binyamin. That's a beautiful point. I would counter and say that while it might be true that the initial war against Binyamin seemed to be sanctioned because of that, the fallout from the war is definitely points to true depravity, where all of Binyamin was wiped out, except for a handful of Binyamin men. And essentially, Bnei Yisrael realized that they had almost eradicated an entire Shevet. And so they say, well, who are the Binyamin men going to marry if we've killed everybody else? So A, Bnei Yisrael went way too far. They killed the women and the children. They didn't just kill the military men of Binyamin. But then they had a meeting and they realized that there was one small city called Yavesh Gilad, who didn't actually participate in the eradication of Shevet Binyamin. So they take Yavesh Gilad, they kill everybody except the women. And then they say, wonderful, when the women, these remaining women, when they go out to the field, the men of Binyamin who are left from our demolition of Shevet Binyamin can go out and randomly grab these women of Yavesh Gilad, whose families we have just killed. So again, I don't think that the way that the civil war was played out would in any case be called a holy war. Definitely by the end of Sefer Shoftim, we see the way that they eradicated Shevet Binyamin was probably not sanctioned. Pilagesh Bhagivat of order. There's also evidence of Dan living in the north at the beginning of the book, and at the end they're in the process of migrating north. Beautiful, right? That is a story that I skipped at the end just for time, but for brevity, right? We know that Shevet Dan was wandering during that latter part of Sefer Shoftim, and they're trying to find a place that they could settle, that they can get Nachala, and it does seem that they are traveling north. So I guess giving credence to the possibility of those last few prakim really appearing earlier, but strategically placed later by Shmuel. Great questions, everyone. I know there was one question I didn't really answer because I didn't fully appreciate it and understand it. So if Joel wants to elaborate, if he's still here, or he can.
All right, Rebecca, really, thank you very much. A pleasure to welcome you back virtually to our community back in Toronto and beyond, and to spread the Torah from here everywhere. Really a pleasure to have you, and regards to everybody, and be well, and we look forward to hearing everybody. I have unmuted people if you want to unmute yourself, but thank you. Like I say, tonight, Mark Shapiro, tomorrow morning, 11 o'clock, Rachel Sharansky, on Sefer Shmuel. Everybody's welcome, and we look forward to learning with you. Everybody should be well, be healthy, and let us know all your comments, and hope to see everybody. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Is there a possibility, Rebecca, really fantastic work. Is there a possibility of getting the slides? I just love what you did with the map.
Yes, as I mentioned, all the slides of all the sources, every shir we ever give, they're always posted on our website. Just go to the website, podcast, everything's there for all the hundreds of shir we've had recently.
Can I just ask a question?
I actually have to leave, but I'm going to leave the broadcast on so people can talk and eventually. Okay, thank you very much, but I got to run.
Okay, Rebecca, sorry, I missed the last 20 minutes of the class because I was called up for something. Just when you were talking about the bad Shoftim. But one thing I've always felt that Yiftach has got a bit of a bum rap. It's true he made a terrible, terrible mistake. But to listen to the discussion, the diplomatic discussion, it's such a tour de force that I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful, I don't know what to call it, a monologue or a dialogue, but a wonderful presentation on his part. And at least we should recognize him for really for the positive aspects of what he did.
Who's that?
Any comments?
Rebecca, you're muted. Oh, sorry. I would absolutely agree. I think he is definitely an Ish Chayil, and the way that he is able to eradicate Bnei Amon is definitely one of the stronger enemies of Israel. Is truly amazing. Even if you, I think that he made a terrible mistake, and the reason that I was harping on this mistake and not necessarily presenting his positive aspects is really to illustrate the point of these latter Shoftim, right? That the Tanakh really shows them in, for sure, Yiftach shows him in a dual light, almost similar to Gidon, where they're very strong military forces and where they have this very strong military presence and they're successful. But on the other hand, they also make these terrible personal mistakes. And even if you disagree that Yiftach, even if you believe that Yiftach made a mistake, I think that at least what most Parshanim would agree with is, well, then what he should have done is he should have taken back his promise. But Yiftach couldn't, because the type of person that he was, which really bodes so well for him in a military sense, that he was strong, he was stubborn, that he led Bnei Israel and he led this effort against Bnei Amon successfully. It's those same characteristics that did not allow him to overcome the neder that he made. He could have reneged, he could have revoked, he could have said, I made a mistake, and lived with whatever consequences you live with for revoking the neder. But the fact that he did not was, I think, a personal tragedy and a personal weakness on his part. So I think that both can absolutely be true. I just focused on that more negative part, only to illustrate that that was really a unique aspect of these secondary, the second half of the Sefer, those Shoftim, Yidin, Yiftach, Shimshon, right? Those Shoftim are still very strong. They still had wonderful military victories for Bnei Israel. But unlike the earlier Shoftim, they had these personal failings that are pointed out by Shmuel.
I have a question.
Yeah.
This is obviously somewhat of a deep Hashgafic issue, but the fact that Yiftach was able to attain Ruach HaKodesh, would that put him on a higher level than spiritually than like all of Chazal, Rishonim, Acharonim? I mean, even if they, I mean, obviously Chazal, Rishonim, Acharonim seem to be much higher level than him in their personality, etc. I've often wondered about that. Obviously, it's a different era with a different modality, but
right. I think a different era, different modality. I think too, it's almost impossible to compare, which is why that Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Yiftach b'dara, Shmuel b'dara,
right?
It's almost, it's really impossible to compare across generations. We're not equipped with that ability to talk to Hashem, even through the Urim v'Tumim, and certainly not to have that Ruach HaKodesh placed upon them. The other thing to remember is that when we talk about Avodah Zarah and Molech, and child sacrifice, those things seem so horrific to us, right? It's almost unimaginable that the things that people would do to practice Avodah Zarah in those times. But in those times, it was the culture, right? That was what people were doing. And so even though it seems horrific to us, what Yiftach was doing may have been really just acting in a status quo. He was acting the way his generation was acting, which may be akin to many of the other external forces that we are subject to today. Even though from a moral and ethical perspective, it's hard, we make those judgments because it does seem so horrible to us. I would suggest—
Right. Slavery was a fact of life in the ancient world. The Torah recognizes it and tries to limit it. I mean, there were recently a from the podcast about how to deal with Torah and slavery. There's things that were facts of that were present. I mean, Chazal obviously would say that Avodah Zarah's temptations were much stronger in that period.
Exactly.
There's a new Sefer out about that. I just send people where Rav Reuven Chaim Klein trying to understand ancient idolatry.
Yes. I would also, thank you. I would also recommend the source for those who have not read it, which really really excellent insight into the pulls, the draw of Avodah Zarah in the time period of a more nomadic people and also people who were tied to the land and agriculturally supported. So if you're interested in that, getting that perspective on Avodah Zarah, definitely the source. But what Ariel, what you sent out, God versus God. Excellent. Judaism and idolatry.
The idolatry, yeah.
I would love to read that. Thank you. That's excellent.
And yeah, he both talks about, I mean, I haven't read it yet, but I get the sense that he talks about both Chazal's perspective on Avodah Zarah, but also the Axial Age and how the beginnings of science Greece, pre-Socratic, you know.
Thank you so much.
The decline of Avodah Zarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's excellent. That's an excellent point, Ariel. Thank you. Yeah.
Rebecca, getting back to the sacrifice of that daughter, doesn't the Torah provide mechanisms for absolution from foolish vows?
Absolutely. I believe we read about it in last week's Parsha.
Yeah. So there was a way of getting around it. If 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what we were talking about with the Niederhofers right before, right? That Gideon had this quality, this personality, which served him very, very well from a military perspective as a general, that he was unbending, he was unwilling to bend to anyone else's whims, which is what made him so successful as a general and as someone who was able to push back the Bnei Amon, but it was the same personality trait that did not allow him to revoke his vow, did not allow him to enact those very principles that you're talking about of revoking a neder, which he could have done and lived with those consequences, but he was unwilling to do. And if you agree either that he sacrificed his daughter, that he banished her, whatever it was, it doesn't matter. He was unwilling to go back on that vow. And I think that that was a major failing. I think that's a great point, Steve. Yeah. All right. Well, anyone, you can feel free to...
Were you conscious of the fact that your final slide lists those three things that the Gemara says brought about the end of the whole enterprise 450 years after the end of the Sefer?
Yes, I actually forgot to talk about that, right? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, and Shfichut Damim, but I deliberately put those on there and made that equivalency to evoke those three things, that those are the things that essentially brought about the destruction of all of Bnei Yisrael, as you so beautifully pointed out. And so this really was, it felt like the end of Sefer Shoftim felt like very similar to that time period 450 years later. I think that's a beautiful point and one that I forgot to point out. Beautiful. All right. Well, if anyone has any more questions, feel free. You can ask me. I'll stay on for a couple more minutes. Otherwise, I'm happy to leave my email address. I'll type it into the chat box if anyone wants to continue discussion.
Thank you so much.
It was really wonderful to meet everybody. And thank you. All of your insights and questions were wonderful and have given me something to think about. And I'm sure you'll get a great, stimulating and exciting shiur tomorrow as well.
Thank you. Thanks, Rebecca. Bye.
Thank you so much.